From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. What do those 3x5 cards say on Tom Brokaw's desk? On this edition of Fresh Air, we'll find out. As he did with the Democrats, he'll be covering the Republican National Convention along with Robert McNeil and Jim Lehrer on PBS. Also, William Vollman has written books on prostitutes and Afghanistan, and now he's at work on a 7-volume historical novel called Seven Dreams, a book of North American landscapes. So far, he's up to volume 2, about the period of Canadian history when the French Jesuits came to convert the Iroquois. And film critic John Powers reviews Single White Female, the new Barbet Schroeder film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas says that his country is prepared to send 1,100 troops with their equipment to Bosnia. Speaking in a televised interview, Dumas said other countries should also do their part to help protect the relief agencies. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Foreign Minister Roland Dumas said the force was made up of 4 units, a helicopter unit, one for light armored vehicles, a transport unit, and an engineering unit. He said that since the contingent was a national force, it would operate under the French flag. Dumas' announcement follows the approval of a UN Security Council resolution which allows the use of force as a last resort to deliver humanitarian aid to Bosnia. During the interview, Dumas was asked if France was prepared to use force. The foreign minister said the contingent would protect relief supplies. There have been a number of calls in France for limited airstrikes against the Serbs in Bosnia, but French President François Mitterrand has ruled that out. He said France would only take part in UN-backed humanitarian efforts there. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Reporters in the western part of Bosnia-Herzegovina say that Serbian women and children are being held in Croatian jails and detention camps in violation of the Geneva Conventions. An Associated Press report said that dozens of women were being held in Croat-controlled territory by members of an extreme right-wing Croatian militia. It said that women and children are being used in exchanges for Croatian prisoners of war. The Red Cross has accused all parties in the civil war of violating the conventions regarding the detention of civilians. The prisoners interviewed said that their treatment was generally good, although some male prisoners claimed that they were falsely identified as Serbian soldiers. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. ruled today that John Hinckley is liable for damages to 3 men stemming from the 1981 assassination attempt on President Reagan. Laura Canoy reports.
Press Secretary James Brady and 2 security men, Thomas Delahunty and Timothy McCarthy, were wounded when Hinckley tried to kill then-President Reagan in March 1981. The 3 brought suit against Hinckley a year later. U.S. District Judge John Garrett Penn ruled today Hinckley is liable for the losses those injuries caused. Judge Penn said another trial must be held to determine how much Hinckley owes and whether Hinckley should pay punitive damages to punish him for his actions. Hinckley's attorneys argued he was insane when he tried to kill President Reagan, so the court couldn't make him pay damages. But Judge Penn said regardless of whether Hinckley was sane or insane, he must compensate his victims. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street on the strength of another round of mostly positive economic statistics. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to close at 3,328.7. This is NPR News. The White House said today that U.S. military planes will begin emergency airlifts of food to Somalia as soon as possible. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that President Bush has directed that an additional 145,000 tons of American food be made available for Somalia. The United States has already provided $77 million in food. Nearly 1.5 million people in Somalia are believed to be in imminent danger of starvation. Coast Guard investigators say they've found a rock with what appears to be red paint on it near the location where the Queen Elizabeth II grounded off the coast of Massachusetts last Friday. Investigators say samples are being tested to see if they match the paint on the hull of the luxury liner. Meanwhile, the shipowners now say the QE2 suffered more damage than initially thought. Virginia Bigger of member station WBUR reports.
Officials from Cunard Lines, owner of the QE2, say the keel of the vessel is damaged and extensive repair is needed to make the ship seaworthy. Originally, they thought damage to be more superficial. Testimony continued today before the Coast Guard Board looking into the matter. The local pilot who guided the QE2 through waters near Martha's Vineyard Island told the board he directed the ship to head off course, but the ship's captain ordered the QE2 back to its original route in order to avoid some shoals. The accident happened soon thereafter. The pilot said he agreed with the captain's decision. The QE2 remains in a Boston dry dock for repair. Cunard Lines say they hope to get the ship sailing by the end of September. For National Public Radio, this is Virginia Bigger in Boston.
The Commerce Department reported today that business inventories grew in June, another sign that consumers are still reluctant to spend money. The report said that inventories rose by 0.6%. That's potential bad news for producers because it means that businesses will be less likely to reorder until they're confident they can move merchandise off their shelves. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Beginning Monday, the Republican Party will get its best primetime shot to convince the nation to vote for George Bush. My guest, Tom Brokaw, is heading for the Astrodome in Houston, which is being transformed to accommodate the thousands of Republicans and journalists expected in that hot and humid city. The three major networks have reduced their coverage, preferring not to preempt all of their regular primetime fare. But once again, NBC and PBS will collaborate on earlier evening convention coverage. From 8 until 10 in the evening, PBS viewers will be able to watch the low-key Jim Lehrer and Robert McNeil of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour interact with the more upbeat commercial team of John Chancellor and Tom Brokaw. Tom Brokaw is the host of NBC's Nightly NewsHour and a veteran of political conventions. We called him to find out how he's preparing for next week's convention coverage.
I organize myself in one single black notebook, heavily indexed. I divide it along the personalities: Bush, Quayle, Ford, Reagan, Mrs. Bush, and then I have sections called themes in which I try to break it down into the issues of the day, the economy, abortion, the state of the party. And then I have another section that I simply call lines, and those lines may be quotes from Republican Party hardliners who say this is still the Reagan Party, for example. That's Vin Weber this morning quoted in the paper, and I try to load that up. And then I load up what I call my computer, my head, by absorbing as much as I can. And I've been doing this for a while now, and I'm always a little astonished at kind of what filters through when I get there in the anchor booth.
Kind of like studying for SATs?
I suppose, although it's been a while since I've done that, and I'd like to think I'm going to do this better than I did on my essay.
Okay. Well, with all the goings-on before the convention, I'm thinking about the appointment of Baker to lead the Bush campaign, the issues about abortion, affairs. What do you see the big issues being coming into this convention?
Well, I think you touched on it at the beginning with the reappointment of Jim Baker, which is that we'll all be looking to see how he tightens the organization, which has really been a shambles by all descriptions of those people within the campaign and those of us on the outside watching it and dealing with it. So I think organizationally he's going to have to pull it together, and then he's going to have to decide what is the message that George Bush wants to convey and how is he going to convey it. There is a bit of a schism in the party right now because a lot of the people who still have their hands on the convention machinery, that is the platform and the speakers and that kind of thing, are old Reagan Republicans, and they want the Reagan Party to continue what they think of as the Reagan Revolution to go on. George Bush has always been a kind of an assimilated member of that branch of the party. He's played his role very well, but the question is he in political peril if he continues in that way?
Well, how do you get around the picture that the party wants the public to see?
Oh, you do that with analysis, and you do that by, you know, providing context. I think, our job is not just to be a mirror there, just to hold it up and let them say what they want to say. We're constantly questioning the principles, and we're providing our own analysis. It doesn't mean that we're just naysaying for the sake of naysaying. We're just trying to put it in some context.
What would you say about this marriage, as you called it, between NBC and PBS? How have you learned to work together?
It began with a very good foundation because we all have a personal affection one for the other. Not just the principals who are on the air, Robin and Jim and John Chancellor and me, but the people behind the scenes. Les Crystal, who's their producer, used to be the president of NBC News. Judy Woodruff used to work for us. Charlene Hunter Gold is one of my best friends in New York. Mark Shields has been a pal of mine for a long, long time. David Gergen was a big source of mine when he was in the White House. So we, you know, we have a very strong personal relationship and shared values, I think.
Was it something to get used to the non-commercial pace of PBS?
A little bit. I think that we found a common ground. I think that we met them halfway. I think the first night it was probably more of the stately pace of PBS, and then you know, they kind of stepped on their accelerator a little more, and we adjusted our own shifting, and we found a pretty good middle ground for us. You know, I'm grateful to have that chance to do things at some length.
Well, do you miss commercials at all in that they do give a breather every now and then? They give you a minute or two to collect your thoughts.
Yeah, but conventions are filled with speakers who give you the same.
Okay. What do you think President Bush is going to have to do at this convention? And do you think his speech is going to be the most important thing that he can contribute to the convention?
Yeah, it's probably the single most important thing that he'll do. But I think that there's a kind of a larger challenge before them, which is the big picture that they present at the convention. He's got to find another way of connecting to the American people besides the phrase, "I hear you." I think that that only triggers the reaction in the minds of too many Americans. Where have you been? This has been going on for a long time, the recession and these complaints that we have. So I think what the Republican Party has to do is decide what it is and how it wants to get on with the business. The danger for the Republicans is that they will become, at their convention, victims of what can only be described as a kind of Democratic disease, is that they will be so divided between the middle Republicans and the right Republicans, those to the right, that they will come out of there with a muddled message and lots of petty squabbling.
You said that Bush really has to get beyond the "I care" message to the American people. How can he do that? I mean, is it literally just a matter of choosing other words?
Yes, it's that, and some specific programs, and showing some compassion, and you know, I have said publicly and otherwise, I think he has to spell out what his vision for the country is. I thought that it just was astonishing that, a little more than a year ago when he won Operation Desert Storm, in effect, and had the country in his hands, that he didn't go to the land in that appearance before Congress, reach over Congress and say to the American people, "We've demonstrated what we can do in a war in a far-off and hostile place, and now we must turn our attention to those problems that bedevil us here at home."
Let me ask you about some questions that were asked of President Bush this week by NBC's Stone Phillips on Dateline NBC, asking Bush about whether he'd had an affair, and asking questions about abortions, about whether what he would do if his granddaughter was pregnant and had an abortion. Do you see that there are appropriate questions for a sitting president and appropriate questions for someone that's running for president?
I certainly think the abortion question is an appropriate question. It is, you know, one of the principal themes of this Republican Party, and it is something that is debated with great emotion, and it's an enormously important issue to a great many Americans, men and women. And the president's message on abortion over the years has been slightly confusing. You know, he changed his position at some point. Recently, we had Dan Quayle saying that he would stand by his daughter if she decided to have an abortion. But the position of the administration and the Republican Party platform has been that women ought not to be allowed to have that choice.
So are we any clearer on the abortion issue at the end of this week?
What we're clear on is that the Bush family is troubled by the issue. And that, you know, given Mrs. Bush's comments to Time magazine as well this week, she didn't even think it should be in the platform. And yet many Republicans think it's one of the litmus tests of who we are. The question of the affair is a trickier question.
Yeah.
And Stone and I talked about it. And what you needed to see, apart from that question, was the way Stone very skillfully led up to it by raising the whole issue of family values and how do we define family values, and the question then of personal behavior and character and whether that is a legitimate issue. in the campaign and in the arena of American politics. And then because this question has been raised, and I know that you probably have heard it in your office before as well about George Bush and whether or not he's had an affair. Given how some of the Republican Party operatives have been encouraging continuing coverage of Governor Clinton's character and his alleged romantic liaisons outside of his family, then he just simply asked the question, the same question, by the way, that George Bush's son asked him 4 years ago.
Are you saying then, as Vice President Quayle said after Clinton was asked about his alleged affairs, let the people decide? Give them the information and let them decide.
Yep. It's not an issue with which I am comfortable. I think it's overstated in both cases. I think that we've spent far too much time, all of us, on this issue. I think it's really something between a man and his wife primarily, unless it begins to spill over to utter deceit and lying to the American people, or it in some way puts the president at some risk or jeopardizes national security.
Tom Brokaw is the host of the NBC Nightly News. He's getting ready for the Republican Party convention, which begins Monday in Houston. NBC and PBS will provide joint coverage of the convention, as they did last month for the Democrats in New York. We'll take a short break and talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Tom Brokaw, host of NBC Nightly News. Barbara Bush felt that Clinton was getting better coverage than her husband, and claim really an old claim that the press is just too darn liberal. Do you agree with that?
I think if you checked with Bill Clinton about 4 months ago, he would not have agreed with that. I think that it rises and falls, these cycles of coverage, and it depends on where they are. Is the press more liberal than the country or more liberal than what? I'm not sure. I think that as individuals, the press may be slightly more liberal than mainstream Americans because of the nature of their lives, where they live and what they bump up against. But I think that the political press in this country is really two things in most political years. I think it is eminently fair to both parties and almost always dead wrong.
What do you think a convention can do to revive a struggling candidate and party?
Well, I think we had a very good example of that in New York. And when Bill Clinton was able to be in the clear, as it were, for a couple of months, get his act together, get his message together, and then turned out that he made what the American people thought was a good choice for vice president in Al Gore. And Gore made a strong impression on the country, and then Clinton came on and, in a well-orchestrated environment, was able to make what most people found to be quite a convincing speech. You know, remember, George Bush was able to do the same thing 4 years ago. He was trailing Michael Dukakis by a pretty desperate margin after the Democrats had gathered in Atlanta, and then Bush made the speech of his life in New Orleans and kind of reclaimed the turf.
He, of course, had Peggy Noonan helping him with that speech.
Yep.
Are you expecting...
Maybe she wrote it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, are you expecting the second speech of his life?
It's not his strongest suit as a politician, and he knows that. I mean, this is no secret. The big speech. And whether or not he can do it twice, we'll just have to wait and see. And I know everybody will tune in NBC next week to find out.
Right. So who gives a better party, an after-party party, the Democrats or Republicans?
Oh, it's all the same. And the fact is, and on that count, you can go back to what George Wallace said. You can put all these people in a gunny sack and shake them up, and when they came tumbling out, there wouldn't be a dime's difference between them. When it comes to giving parties, they all get pretty good parties, and they all have a good time. The people who show up at conventions are the political pros, the activists, and, you know, many of them socially have great friends across party lines. I won't do this for your program, but I could put together a dinner party, a half Republican, half Democrat, and they would all know each other very well and all have stories one on the other and kind of pick up where they last left off.
Do you go to the parties or do you?
No, not. Well, I go some at the beginning because it's great. You know, it's no secret, I suppose. It's like the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. You get to see all of your friends. You know, you get to see all the big players in one room and kind of touch base and pick up the latest gossip and move around. Then when the convention begins, you know, the party time winds down a lot more. The best single social convention I can remember was San Francisco. First of all, it was San Francisco. And then it was in the Western time zone. So we were done every night by about 9:15 San Francisco time. So we all repaired to a place called the Washington Square Bar and Grill. And it was owned by a saloon owned by a pal of mine. And honest to God, the last night that we were there, there were people outside the Washington Square Bar and Grill hanging on the windowsills, peering in, because at one table, it was Walter Cronkite and his wife and Art Buchwald and assorted CBS cronies. At another table, it was Bob Strauss and the powers that be of the Democratic Party. At another table, it was Roone Arledge and David Brinkley and his whole crowd. At another table, I was sitting with Ben Bradley and Sally Quinn and Rick Kurtzberg from the New Republic and a group of my pals. Then there were senators and party activists all over the place, and it got to be kind of hilarious because the people on the outside looking in quite a joyful mood began doing kind of play-by-play. They started saying things like, oh, look, Walter has just ordered the Duckhorn Merlot.
See, I was feeling sorry for you having to cover this convention until now.
Well, I don't think it'll be quite, the ambience will not be quite as good, but, you know, there's good food to be had in Houston, great barbecue. There's a wonderful place called the original Nymphas, which is a Southwest cooking, and it's just a good time. And these are interesting times in our country and in our lives, and we'll see how this party, which has always managed in the last 15 years at least, to kind of get itself organized, can do it again.
Are we going to see you on Jay Leno again?
Probably, yeah. Try to restrain myself.
No, we enjoyed it very much. Tom Brokaw, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Okay.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
Tom Brokaw is the host of the NBC Nightly News. He will co-host, along with Jim Lehrer and Robert McNeil, PBS's and NBC's joint coverage of the Republican convention. Singer-songwriter Caetano Veloso is a leading Brazilian example of the generation of musicians who discovered that all the experiments of modernism could be applied to popular music. He's been compared to Bob Dylan and John Lennon, and like them, he is ferociously independent and consciously literary, convinced that a song can make any sort of statement. World music commentator Milo Miles has a survey of his work.
Apaixonei-me, difícil acreditar. Sem preconceito, sempre eu vou te amar.
I'm very torn about the celebrated Caetano Veloso. He's made more than 25 records since 1967, and of those I've heard, each includes at least one track so shapely and deft it knocks me out. Unfortunately, most of his albums also contain two or three guitar and voice numbers that put me to sleep, and a host of subtle cuts that leave me indifferent. Of all his adventurous peers, such as Gal Costa and Gilberto Gil, Veloso is the whitest and most bossa nova bound. And although he lapses into occasional dippy meditations on the moon and sun, the surf and the sand, the main problem with Veloso's softer stuff is that I don't understand Portuguese. Unless you do, you're left with the pretty but unexceptional music and his rather wan voice, not much power, not much range. But still,
Não me amarra dinheiro, não. Mas formosura, dinheiro não. A pele escura, dinheiro não. A carne dura, dinheiro não. Moça preta do Curuzu, beleza pura, federação. Beleza pura, boca do rio. Beleza pura, dinheiro não. Quando essa preta começa a tratar do cabelo, é de se olhar toda a trama da trança, trança do cabelo. Conchas do mar, ela manda buscar pra botar no cabelo. Toda minúcia, toda delícia.
I keep listening to more Veloso and liking him better. He never finds beauty in overproduction or tubby orchestration, and when you can get translations of his lyrics, many of them are quite smart. He identifies with the underclass, and he can throw out vivid details about alienation in consumer society and intoxication with a sudden romance. And he obviously reads serious literature without moving his lips. An agreeable Veloso sampler is called Personalidade. If you like that, other recommended albums recently reissued on CD are Uns, which is quite varied and flowing, and Otras Palavras, which is sort of his soul album. The best news is that Veloso is making the finest recordings of his career right now. They're produced by Arto Lindsay, the post-punk guitarist and bandleader who grew up in Brazil. The advantage of Lindsay's participation is not only his lyric translations, but that he gets Veloso away from mere minor chords and into some outright dissonance and crashing percussion. Veloso's experiments don't sound quaint anymore, especially on 1989's Estrangeiro. It suggests one of those rich magic realism novels from South America with bits of sex, death, drunkenness, and carnival colors swirling around like confetti.
O pintor Paul Gauguin amou a luz na Baía de Guanabara. O compositor Cole Porter adorou as luzes na noite dela. A Baía de Guanabara. O antropólogo Claude Lévi-Strauss detestou a Baía de Guanabara. Pareceu-lhe uma boca banguela. E eu, menos a conhecera, mais a amara. Sou cego de tanto vê-la, de tanto tê-la estrela. O que é uma coisa bela. O amor é cego. Ray Charles é cego. Stevie Wonder é cego.
Veloso's latest, Circulado, is somewhat slacker than Estrangeiro, probably because there's not enough gnashing guitar from the likes of Bill Frisell and Mark Ribbett. But dang, if Veloso doesn't continue to soften my resistance to his brand of fancy. Now I'm even going along with a slow track in which he makes his affection for a town sound like a passionate fling with a woman, right down to her white sands, her mud, and her algae.
Itapuã, tuas luas cheias, tuas casas feias, viram tudo, tudo, inteiro de nós. Itapuã,
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed the music of Brazilian singer-songwriter Caetano Veloso. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoane with Fresh Air. When William Volman undertakes a writing project, there's no telling what he'll choose. His topics range from science fiction to prostitution to Afghanistan. His latest is a 7-volume historical novel of North America. He's just finished writing part 2. Coming up, we talk to Volman about imagining the landscapes of the past. That and more coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials at the White House have announced that the Pentagon will start emergency airlifts of food to Somalia as soon as possible. Thousands of people have already died of starvation in the nation, and aid workers say 1.5 million more could die within weeks. Bush administration officials are also proposing that the UN convene a donors' conference, including major factions in Somalia, to gain their cooperation in making sure that the aid gets through. In advance of next week's Republican convention, GOP officials see Texas as critical to the president's reelection bid. Polls in the state now have Bill Clinton ahead, and the Bush campaign hopes to close the gap with a boost from the Houston convention, plus a blitz of hard-hitting negative campaign ads. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Bush Quail campaign in Texas plans to launch Operation September Storm against Bill Clinton, according to a report in the Dallas Morning News today. The report quotes Bush campaign associates here who say a series of television and radio ads and direct mail will portray Clinton as an extremist on social values, specifically attacking his support of homosexual rights and gun control. The plan is to reestablish Mr. Bush's base in conservative rural East Texas and in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where he's slipping in public opinion polls. Texas holds 32 electoral votes, and Mr. Bush has been trailing here by 14 percentage points in polls. Gun control is a controversial issue in Texas. Its residents are rigid about their right to own firearms. A billboard just outside the convention site, sponsored by the National Rifle Association, reminds politicians that the organization represents millions of Americans who vote. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Houston.
Poor and elderly Californians could be denied health care beginning next week. A federal court has ordered California to stop paying doctors and hospitals that care for the indigent. NPR's Elaine Corey reports.
California has gone 45 days now without a budget. The state has issued nearly $1 billion in IOUs to pay for the Medi-Cal program, California's version of Medicaid. But yesterday, a federal appeals court told the state to suspend all Medi-Cal payments until a budget is signed. The final IOUs went out last night. Dwayne Donner is with a trade group representing 500 California hospitals.
Patients will be hurt. They will not receive care. Hospitals will not have resources to pay employees or to pay their suppliers and vendors for goods and services and drugs.
Governor Pete Wilson unveiled his latest budget proposal today, but Wilson and Democratic lawmakers remain deadlocked over how to bridge a nearly $11 billion shortfall. In San Francisco, I'm Elaine Corey.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 15 points in active trading. This is NPR News. The Navy has reportedly ordered a U.S. aircraft carrier closer to Bosnia. This means that the Saratoga and the USS Biddle are now in position to help out in U.N. efforts to get food and medicine to the nation torn by civil war. One Pentagon official is quoted as saying that they are edging a little closer to the scene as a precaution, and if there is a need to do something. Yesterday, the U.N. Security Council approved a measure authorizing all necessary measures, including the use of force as a last resort, to make sure that aid supplies get through. Haitian police detained more than 150 boat people for questioning today, just after the would-be refugees were returned home by U.S. officials. All but 13 of 14 of these returnees were freed after several hours. But NPR's Paz Cohen reports these detentions raised fresh questions about President Bush's decision to forcibly repatriate all Haitians picked up on the high seas.
The Haitian police told U.S. authorities they wanted only to identify the organizers and crew of the abortive boat trip as part of a crackdown on people smugglers and boat thieves. If they're doing what they say, a State Department official said, then you can't object to that. But throughout the day, many did object. Advocates for the boat people on Capitol Hill and human rights activists fear Haitian authorities are really trying to identify political organizers and the people helping them escape. They say today's detentions illustrate how easy it is for Haiti's rulers to nab whole boatloads of people as we return them. And that, one source said, clearly makes it easy for them to identify political activists. U.S. authorities say they'll monitor what happens to the returnees still in custody. I'm Pas Cohen reporting.
The government says that business inventories climbed 0.6% in June. That's their highest point in nearly a year and a half. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Writer William Volman turned 33 this year. He also had 3 books published by 3 major publishers, and he's never had a literary agent. Volman researched Whores for Gloria by hanging out in San Francisco's Tenderloin District, where he could satisfy his obsession with prostitutes. He also gathered material on the resident psychopaths, deviants, alcoholics, and skinheads for an earlier book, The Rainbow Stories. In 1990, Volman embarked on an ambitious project he calls The Seven Dreams Cycle. It's a series of 7 books that will tell a symbolic history of North America, beginning with the invasion of the Vikings in 1000 AD. The second volume, Fathers and Crows, has just been published. It's set in 17th century Canada, and it's about the competition between the French Jesuits, Indians, and fur trappers. Though the books are fiction, Volman does exhaustive research. He's taken several trips to the Arctic and the magnetic North Pole to try to get inside the minds and feelings of the explorers he's writing about. Critical praise for Fathers and Crows has been dramatic. A review in the Chicago Tribune said, if not the great American novel, it is likely to become one of the masterpieces of the century. Volman's fictional history doesn't simplify the motives and relations between the Indians and the European settlers.
I guess I'm a little bit concerned at the moment with the glorification of Native Americans. I think that Native Americans have a lot to teach me. I don't think that Native Americans are any better than Europeans or vice versa. It always kind of saddens and disappoints me to see how easy it is for most people to just say that one group is better than another. You know, maybe a generation ago, my friends might have said that Native Americans were savages and they had a lot to learn from Europeans. And now it's the other way around, and I just don't have too much patience with that. When I was writing Fathers and Crows, you know, I kept coming across all these horrific descriptions of things that the Indians would do to each other and equally horrific things that the Europeans would do to each other. And that's just how life is and how history is.
You have a wonderful sentence in this latest novel about history. And you write, for history is like a string that the cat has swallowed, drawing events and events from the poor creature's throat. One is surprised at how much must be disgorged. Is that how you think about writing and discovering history?
Yeah, that's really how it seems to me. You just have to go back and back and back way before your beginning if you want to understand the beginning. And oftentimes you have to go forward beyond the end. I don't think Hemingway would have approved of that method very much. But for history, I think it's really important. If you're going to bring the whole sweep of history alive, you have to make sure that you're grounded before and after.
In creating the kinds of characters that you do for Fathers and Crows, some of whom have real names that we would remember from history classes, and some of whom are people that you have created, how do you try to understand them, and how do you even understand their speech patterns, their fears, getting inside of their heads?
Well, Champlain is I guess an easy example, and he I think is one of my particular successes in the book. His collected works runs about 6 volumes. And most of it is reports of discoveries, treatises on navigation, things like that. Nothing terribly personal. But you can read that stuff and reread it, and after a while, you get some understanding of how he used language and some understanding possibly of his preoccupations. Then, you can crib and plagiarize a little bit from those, put a couple of those words in his mouth, get lists of phrases, and after a while, you can start duplicating those phrases, make up phrases similar to that, and you continue to read and reread the history of the time and see Champlain as others described him, and then you can start bringing him alive a little bit.
Sounds like a form of theater.
Yeah, in a way it is. It's also a lot, I think, like the spiritual exercises of the Jesuits.
How do you mean that?
Well, it's this interior building. You sit there and close your eyes and try to create your own versions of things so that they will be real to you. One of the big exercises in the spiritual exercises, for instance, is to imagine that you can see both heaven and hell. It doesn't say, all right, now look at heaven and you should be able to see a blue sky with white clouds, and look down into hell and you should be able to see devils with red tails and so on and so forth. You're supposed to bring your own visualizations to that. And that's more or less what I've done. I think, 10 other authors could have read Champlain's work and come up with 10 different Champlains. And yet if we all had some degree of faithfulness and integrity, there would be a certain amount of overlap there, or at least I like to think so.
My guest today on Fresh Air is William Volman, and he's just written a new book. It's the second in a series of novels that he's writing about the symbolic histories of North America. This latest book is called Fathers and Crows. Also, he has a book about traveling to Afghanistan in the early 80s to see the war there. That book has just been published, and it's called An Afghanistan Picture Show. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer William Volman. You worked as a computer programmer at a firm in Silicon Valley. When did you become a writer?
Well, I guess when I was 6 or 7, I knew that's what I wanted to do. I was always writing stories out by hand and drawing pictures. It actually isn't too different from what I do now, I guess.
What did you write about when you were 6 or 7?
Mainly science fiction things, people exploring alien suns, this and that. In some ways, that's not too different either.
Well, when did you begin to take yourself seriously as a writer? I guess it's hard to take a 6 or 7-year-old exactly seriously.
I guess when I decided to go to Afghanistan, I really wanted to do something that would help humanity somehow. And help the Afghans in particular. And I tried to think of various things that I could do. It seemed like probably the best thing would be to write a book about them and make people understand what their problems were.
Why did you have to go all the way to Afghanistan to help humanity?
Well, because I was a jerk. I didn't know any better. I could have very easily just tried to help myself, or just go right outside my front door and find somebody who needed help. But at the time, there was the lure of the exotic experience, and I'd just seen Lawrence of Arabia. I thought, wow, what a great thing! Maybe I can do something like that. And instead, I went over there, and despite my best efforts, I was just kind of a trial and a burden to everybody because I didn't know how to do anything. And everyone was counting on me to, you know, to be a big shot and get them all $1,000 and a dozen Stinger missiles and so on and so forth. And I couldn't do anything. When I got back, I couldn't even get on the radio and talk about it or do anything. And no one wanted to publish the book. It sat around for about 10 years, during which time I sort of tinkered with it and changed the narrative structure quite a bit.
Well, let me read a section from an Afghanistan picture show, and you write, "Once upon a time, there was a young man who wanted to be more than he really was. This made him unhappy. He decided to go to Afghanistan to take pictures of the bullets whizzing past his ears. Unfortunately, he had a stomach ache." That's you?
That's how it was. I did my best, and my best sure wasn't good enough.
Well, you're going back to Yugoslavia in just a couple of weeks, going back to another conflict. Do you know what you'll be looking for?
No, I really don't. It's an assignment for the LA Times, and they just want me to use whatever skills I have to get a human interest story. I'm pretty good at listening to people. And I don't mind a little discomfort, so I think I might be able to see some things that other journalists can't see. But I have to leave myself open, as always, and just see how things are when I'm over there. Maybe I'll go to Sarajevo, maybe I'll go some other place. I don't know yet.
Well, talking about listening to people and hanging out with people, you've written a lot about prostitutes, and I know that you've hung out with streetwalkers and drug dealers, Nazi skinheads, and others. Is there an art to doing that? A skill?
Well, I suppose. My friend Ken Miller, who has worked with me with these people for a long time, takes pictures of them, which should be in more of my books than they are. He says the main trick is always give them something and always tell them what they want to hear. My own personal strategy is just always give them something and always listen to them.
You've chosen prostitutes as people to spend time with to get to know. Why them?
Well, all my books are about love. In Fathers and Crows, for instance, the whole story is about how the Jesuits really loved the Indians. They wanted to save their souls with various foreseen and unforeseen consequences. The Afghanistan book is about how I tried to love people and I wanted to do something to express that. Prostitution is a very interesting form of love. And the more I hang around with prostitutes, the more different kinds of love I see. It's kind of an inexhaustible theater and laboratory for me.
Let me ask you about an incident that happened in your childhood. And when you were 9 years old, you were told to keep an eye on your six-year-old sister. And she drowned.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's correct.
What happened?
Well, we were at a pond, and the bottom of the pond had a sharp drop off. My little sister couldn't swim, and she was waiting around, and I was doing something. I don't exactly remember what. I was probably dreaming with my head in the clouds, and I looked around, and she wasn't there. She had disappeared. And of course, she was on the bottom of the pond at that time.
What kind of effect did that have on you?
Well, it didn't tend to make me feel terribly good about myself, as you can imagine. It made me want to try and make it up to somebody somehow, which is probably one reason why I went to Afghanistan. And one reason why I always would like to do things that could help people. It probably made me more honest in the end, too, because there was no way I could not be honest about it. For years and years, I was always thinking about it. And so it makes me not really afraid of being unpopular or having other people consider me wrong or feeling uncomfortable around me, because I kind of put myself through all that, and I feel like I can say in my books whatever I need to say, and if other people disagree with it, that's okay with me.
What was your family's reaction to what happened?
They weren't too happy about it.
Did they blame you?
It's hard to say. I think, you know, to some extent they did. I'm sure they blamed themselves as well.
Is it still an issue?
No, not really. Not as, you know, not for them and me. I mean, you know, we still remember her birthday. We remember the day that she died, and we talk about it. But we go on with our lives.
You've said that you feel like an outsider. Do you think this incident contributes to that feeling?
I'm sure it did, yes.
You also call yourself William the Blind. You have you have eye problems, is that right?
That's right. I wear glasses. yeah, and I do have eye problems. I wanted some kind of persona to adopt for the Seven Dreams. And it seemed like William the Blind was an appropriate one. Here's this chronicler, this historian, who's trying to get everything's right, you know, who draws his own maps. And sometimes maybe the scale on the maps is not perfect. Sometimes maybe he gets a few details wrong. After all, he wasn't there in the 1600s or in 1000 AD. And he's doing his best, but... as usual, his best probably isn't good enough, since no one's is.
And since he's William the Blind.
Well, exactly.
thank you, William Volman, for joining us on Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you.
William Volman's second in a 7-part series of symbolic histories of North America has just been published. It's called Fathers and Crows. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about today's show. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. Mara Liasson is giving us a piece tonight on parsing the Republican Party, all of the bits and pieces of the party and how they come together and come apart, as we will see in the convention next week and the election to come. We have a number of pieces on the war in the Balkans, including one from Silvia Poggioli, who's been in some very dangerous and frightening situations in the last few days. And we have an interview with Herschel Shanks, who is the editor of the Biblical Archaeology Review, on a piece which will be published next week on the tomb of Caiaphas, the high priest who condemned Jesus.
Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Single White Female is a new movie about a living situation gone bad, very bad. Critic John Powers has this review.
Going to the movies these days is like paying a trip to the paranoia factory. Hollywood is feeding our terror of everything. Nannies, house sitters, one-night stands, over-solicitous cops, women. A classic case in point is Single White Female, which takes a common urban bummer looking for a roommate and inflates it into a horror show. Bridget Fonda plays Allie, a Manhattan businesswoman who breaks up with her straying boyfriend and advertises for a roommate. She winds up with a real humdinger. Hetty, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, is the roommate from hell, a needy psycho in search of a psyche to emulate. She's barely in the door before she's copying Allie's fashionable looks and watching over her like a jealous lover.
I've been waiting since 6 o'clock last night to hear from you. I've been worried sick. Sorry, I guess I just didn't think.
No, you didn't. And there's such a thing as a phone, you know? This is New York. Things happen.
Do they ever? Single White Female was directed by Barbe Schroeder, the German-born director whose last picture, Reversal of Fortune, turned the story of Klaus and Sonny von Bülow into a black comedy. For the first 45 minutes, this new movie seems to have a similar dark intelligence, harking back to pictures like Ingmar Bergman's Persona and David Cronenberg's Dead Ringers, movies where characters merge psychologically. Hedy starts stealing her roommate's life, beginning with her clothes, then moving to her hairstyle, and finally on to her boyfriend. Fonda and Lee are two of the best young actresses now working in Hollywood, and what's best in this movie is their clash of personal styles. Fonda is a lanky charmer, all long legs and high cheekbones. Her every move suggests poise and elegance. And Lee makes a perfect nemesis. She almost engulfs her co-star with her bad posture, doughy face, and sprawling emotionalism. The effect is pretty eerie. But like so many movies with plum roles for actresses, Single White Female is secretly contemptuous of women. It dishes up all manner of paranoid hooey about the two faces of womanhood. Lovely Allie is the good girl, whose life is empty without a man, while plain Hedy is just another of those fatally attracted killers, the incarnation of nutso femininity, the lunatic female unconscious that must be destroyed for the good girl to live. Last summer, Thelma and Louise traveled together and became whole. Theirs was a story of women's growth. Single White Female is a twisted women's buddy picture, a fable about women's hopelessly divided nature. By the end, it drops any pretense to being a psychological drama and becomes just another crummy slasher pick. And the scariest thing about it is that when the bloodletting starts, so do the cheers of the audience.
John Powers is a reporter for the LA Weekly and reviews films for New York Magazine. For the past several months, Audrey Veblaitis, and that's V-E-B-L-A-I-T-I-S, in case you've wondered, has stood in as our technical director, while Joyce Lieberman has taken some time to be with her new son. Audrey, you've bailed us out of more technical jams than we'd care to remember. Today was no exception. Bravo, Audrey. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tui, and Deborah Beagle. Sue Spolin directed the program with Audrey Veblaitis at the board. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Israeli filmmaker Eran Rickles. His film, Cup Final, is about an Israeli reservist who's captured by Palestinians during the invasion of Lebanon. Despite political differences, the soldier and his captor can agree on their passion for soccer. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.